Mac 11, I squeeze like lemon limes. Squirt, obey your thirst, fashion lines. Between beauty and beast, I walk the line.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point with Jay-Z there. On Monday, Jay-Z and a bunch of his famous friends, Madonna, Rihanna, Kanye West, Daft Punk, Jason Aldean, and others, announced the launch of a new artist-owned music streaming service called Tidal, like the tide. It is twice the price of Spotify and Apple's Beats, but they promise better sound quality and more artist access. The rivalry over streaming and who benefits is heating up. This hour on Point, the music streaming wars, and who wins, the labels, the artists, you? You can join us on air or online with this conversation is always on. How do you listen to music these days? What are you willing to pay for? Where do you stream and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will talk with the brilliant cartoonist Alison Bechtel, whose graphic memoir Fun Home is now Broadway bound. But first, what's heating up in music and streaming? Press conference on Monday announcing the launch of Tidal. Some pretty well-to-do artists there, including singer Alicia Keys, laying out the service's plans.
Our goal is simple. We want to create a better service and a better experience for both fans and artists. And that is our promise to the world.
Key phrase, both fans and artists, you say there, saying there. Here's Madonna in a promotional video for Tidal, Tidal for All, it's called, saying Tidal is changing the model for streaming.
Maybe it sounds like a cliche, but it's about putting art back into the forefront. It's about bringing humanity back to being an artist, not technology, art, human art.
It's about art and humans and the man, Jay-Z, in the same video.
Everyone here is, you know, that term icons, but we've all, at one point, were in love with music. You can't make it to where we, what we've accomplished without having that love of music be the foundation. I think it's one of the things that sets us aside from someone that's a tech company that's selling advertisement or selling hardware. Right now, they're writing a story for us. We need to write the story for ourselves.
Boom, boom. We're not a tech company. We're not selling advertisement. We are the artists. Let's look at what's going on in the world of streaming. With us from Washington, Kelsey McKinney, entertainment and culture reporter for Vox. Kelsey, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
And from Washington, Spencer Kornhaber joins us, pop culture and music writer for The Atlantic. Spencer, welcome to you.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So you look at Tidal, Spencer, and your headline is Long Live Millionaire Musicians. Is that a warm embrace or a cold embrace or an embrace at all?
It's sort of a confused response, I think. I don't know whether to embrace it yet. But there was the press conference on Monday and the rollout for the 24 hours before where all these famous musicians changed their Twitter avatars and were imploring their fans to get on board with this new service. Tidal sort of came as a surprise to a lot of people. Sort of felt like it came out of nowhere. Jay-Z had just recently acquired this Norwegian company, Aspero, which had a streaming service. And all of a sudden, it's supposedly going to save all of the music industry. What they talked about a lot at the press conference were the clips that you just heard and the rhetoric around bringing value back to music and really putting the focus back on the artist. Now, everyone on that stage was already really well established. They've had really amazing careers. But there was very little talk about how this would help younger artists, new artists, more established but niche artists. So there's just no real sense for what this means for the entire picture. Just other than that, it brings publicity and, you know, maybe a little bit more money to the 16 celebrities who are on the stage.
Are they all co-owners of this thing, Spencer?
Those 16? Yeah, apparently. Jay-Z owns by far the biggest share, but apparently all the other ones have a 3% equity share in the company. And Tidal says that it's going to bring in more artists as it goes along with smaller and smaller shares.
Kelsey, take us across the waterfront of this competition now. People have so many options these days when it comes to streaming music. Take us through the major players' strengths and weaknesses as you see them, if you would, Kelsey.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that's really interesting about Tidal is they're kind of marketing themselves as a platform that's good for artists and not necessarily a platform that's good for consumers. But when you actually look at the product, when you download it on your computer, it's really almost identical to products that are already exist on the market. So products like Spotify and RDO and Rhapsody, you can do what Tidal is doing on almost any platform. And their kind of shtick is that you can get this like high quality audio. But the problem is, is, for most listeners, most average listeners, don't have the headphone quality to even distinguish between the two types of audio. And on top of that, they're paying $20 for something that may price them out of the market.
This is $20 per month, right?
Right, yeah. $20 per month for higher quality audio. Now, Tidal does have a lower tier that's at $9.99, which is kind of the standard across the industry right mm-hmm. now for a month of music.
And this is the standard is kind of $10 for unlimited streaming of all the music you can find and consume.
Right. It's unlimited streaming, and it's also on demand, so you mm-hmm. can pick what you hear and in what order. And one problem that Tidal is really going to face in the future is that they're offering almost the exact same thing as Spotify is. So why would I, as a consumer, switch from something that I'm already paying $9.99 for, already know how to use, to this new platform? Maybe I'd do it because of Jay-Z, but maybe I wouldn't.
I mean, Spencer, they're saying we're going to give you extras. I don't know what that is. A video tours of Blue Ivy's baby crib, or I don't know what.
So far, the extras, I'll say, are pretty paltry. You have the first White Stripes appearance on TV, 15 years ago. You have a playlist from Coldplay about their influences, which you can probably guess from listening to their music already. You do have Rihanna's new single. That's probably the biggest exclusive they have. And other than that, it remains to be seen what's going to be put on there. It seems like it would be a good marketing strategy for someone like Rihanna or Kanye West, who are both owners, to put out their new album exclusively on Tidal, at least for a time. But that's a really tough sell to make to a record company or to an artist, because you're sacrificing the potential size of your audience so drastically. So right now it's not clear how powerful these extras that they're offering are going to be for consumers.
Of course, Pandora is huge, but you don't get to choose what you're going to hear if you want to do that. Oh, Spotify, I guess, is the biggest. And there you can move a lot of music in a hurry. Here's a little bit of All Right. This is Kendrick Lamar off his new album, To Pimp a Butterfly. This album broke Spotify streaming records with 9.6 million plays in its first day of service.
We gon' be all right, right. We gon' be all right.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I'll be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the face down.
Pay cut? I don't know. Kendrick got to do all right at those numbers, but there's a lot of tension over who gets what in this new streaming world. Let's go to Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for this program. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, are any of your guests aware of, is anyone trying to form essentially just a musician's guild for streaming, so that streaming technology, Jay-Z and Madonna, they've already made their money. And mm-hmm. the danger with what is currently going on in the music industry is that independents will die and simply not have the ability for the kind of platform that these investors, I think to call them artists at this point is absurd. So is there anything like that currently in the works? Is there any buzz? And if not, I hope someone else out there hears this and maybe you'll make it happen.
Okay, thanks. Camille, we'll hope the same. Kelsey, remind us what streaming has done to musician income. And what about Camille's question? Is there room out there for a guild or a co-op or something, not just for the billionaire millionaires, but for lots of musicians, independents included, that would be good for their bottom line, keep them fed and clothed and making music?
Yeah, absolutely. Camille, thanks so much for your question. This is a big one that a lot of people are asking right now. And I think one of the biggest problems is that a guild may or may not help, right? So there are a few artist conglomerates that are kind of combining right now to stand up and say, hey, we can't make our living off of streaming. We can't make enough money to live a middle-class life in a normal town and be able to pay our bills. And that's a really huge problem. And it's one that the music industry has experienced with every single turn of format. So when we went from vinyl to CDs, when we went from CDs to MP3s, when we're going from MP3s to streaming, we're seeing the same kind of drop-offs in revenue for artists. And that's a really huge concern. But the way streaming is set up right now, both legally and structurally, doesn't really allow for any of those groups to have a huge impact. So even if you had a massive conglomerate of artists who came out and said, like, this is unfair, we're not making enough money, we want things to change, they can't necessarily change the system, because the way it's built right now, labels pretty much decide how much money an artist makes off streaming, and part of their contract that allows for promotion automatically buys them into these programs. So even if they are mad, and a lot of them are, there's not really a lot of recourse they can do to get out of this.
And it's not just money. I mean, the complaint is out there that streaming can turn music into a kind of wallpaper. Here's a little bit of an interview with Virgin Disruptors, with cellist-composer Zoe Keating, saying streaming services take something away from the music.
Music can seem kind of valueless. It's sort of this musical wallpaper. You can just find anything at any time. It's right there at your fingertips. So there's, the streaming services have kind of taken it away from the artists themselves.
Spencer, it was supposed to be the great gusher of art, you know, available to all. Does it, in fact, end up devaluing the art, the music?
That is something you hear a lot. It's not something I'm sure that I can relate to as someone who listens to a ton of music on Spotify, loves music, and knows a lot of people who do. For a music fan, the fact that you can get basically all of recorded music or a lot of recorded music on demand, it is a giant change. And you go from wanting to collect albums and looking at album art to feeling like you have everything. And so that collector's mentality goes away, but you have more of an explorer's mentality, I feel like, where you can just dip into anything without any risk.
And lots of options, it seems, more all the time. Spencer Kornhaber, please stand by. Kelsey McKinney, Spencer at The Atlantic, Kelsey at Vox. We're talking about the music streaming wars, Spotify versus Apple's Beats versus Jay-Z's new artist-owned Tidal and more. And later this hour, we will talk with cartoonist Alison Bechdel about her graphic memoir Fun Home going to Broadway. Rihanna, Kanye West, Paul McCartney right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Now I'm 4 or 5 seconds from wildin', and we got 3 more days till Friday. I'm trying to make it back home by Monday morning. I swear I wish somebody would tell me, ooh, that's all I want. 4 or 5 seconds from wildin', and we got 3 more days till Friday.
This shit, that ice cold Michelle fight. For that white gold, this one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the music streaming wars out there right now. Mark Ronson and featuring Bruno Mars behind us here with Uptown Funk. But of course, you can stream just about anything these days, and the competition is really heating up. Spotify versus Apple's Beats, Jay-Z's new artist-owned Tidal, and more. Kelsey McKinney is with us, entertainment and culture reporter for Vox. Spencer Kornhaber is here, pop culture and music writer for The Atlantic. You can join us. What do you see coming from Apple and Beats? What are you willing to pay? Nothing? Something? How much? And musicians, what are you rooting for here in the music streaming wars? Let's go to our callers. Justin in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Justin, you're on. What do you see? What's working? What's not?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have been paying for Spotify basically since it was available in the United States, and I like it. I'm a musician. I'm a music teacher, and it's important for me to be able to have access to all those things. So I like that about Spotify. I can definitely take into account what people say about it losing its meaning because you're not collecting, you're not buying. I still buy CDs as well, but I don't think you can have it both ways. I think that either you want your music out there and you want to be fairly compensated for it, or you want people to only be able to physically buy an album, in which case people don't really do that anymore.
Justin, what about the options? I mean, now you have so many ways to stream. How have you decided to stick with Spotify? Are you glad for more entrants into this market for different services?
Like I said, I want everybody to be fairly compensated, but yeah, there almost are too many. And honestly, I'm with Spotify because I've been with them the longest, and I have all my playlists through them and have all my artists, you know, saved and whatnot. So it would be like an iPhone versus an Android. I don't really want to make the switch just because it would be more work, I guess.
But they sure would like you to come to them. Everybody wants to get the big numbers in. Here's a commercial for the Beats music streaming service, Apple's.
We've created an elegant, fun solution that integrates the best technology with friendly, trustworthy humanity. It understands music as emotion and joy, culture and life. This is a completely new way to experience music, and the next step in the evolution that's taken us from 45s to CDs to streaming.
For beats there, Kelsey, everybody talks about emotion and joy and culture, and of course that's all in music, but this is real business. How do you interpret what's going on with all these players here? Is their assumption that this is still a wide open market? It's still waiting to be won or lost? You can come in and grab millions of listeners to your service if you tweak it a little bit or market it right?
Yeah, so one thing that these music companies are kind of saying is we know when we look at data of consumption of media in America that people love to consume music. 93% of Americans say that they consume music for leisure. No other media has that, not TV, not radio, nothing else. And so that's an interesting thing if you're starting a new tech company or if you're starting a new business to say, like, which market do people want? And so they come into music thinking this because they know that people love it. But the reality is that a lot of these groups are trying to compete on the exact same playing field for what is a very small portion of the market. So if you look at the music industry at a broad scale, you have most Americans are listening to the radio. Mm-hmm. They listen on AM, FM transmitters in their cars on their way to work. Mm-hmm. The second tier are people who listen to what we call like internet radio, which is its own form of streaming that plays it by its own rules. And these are companies like Pandora. Mm-hmm. And they have a huge portion of the market, like 175 million Americans are getting their music on Pandora.
Wow.
Compared to only 60 on Spotify. So when you look at that huge distinction, what Tidal is doing is it's coming into this further end of the market where a smaller portion of Americans are because it's kind of hot right now. It's sexy. People love Spotify and they talk about it with their friends. They don't talk about Pandora because it's just on. And so one thing that's interesting is it's a great move in terms of passion to come into the smaller section, but it's maybe not the best business move.
But Spencer, is it where the money is? Is that the point?
Well, something that people should keep in mind is that this is still a pretty small and new market as far as paying subscribers to services. You look at Netflix, which has revolutionized TV and movies with streaming, and they have around 57 million people worldwide paying for it. Spotify has 15 million people paying for it. So I think the music industry is looking at that kind of gap and saying, well, why can't we have that many people signing up to pay for music on demand? And once you do grow that pie, if they could possibly do that, it would mean a lot more money in the ecosystem. It would mean that artists get paid more per song that's streamed. But that's a long way to go. Part of the hope with this upcoming relaunch of Beats music, I believe, is to make streaming more ubiquitous, to make it something that, you know, you might have in your car that your grandmother might use. That's sort of the way that people are talking about it going forward, trying to make it for everyone. But whether everyone wants to have on-demand music versus whether they're fine listening to radio or listening to Pandora is an open question.
John in Austin, Texas. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Kind of into a little bit different genre. I'm a lifetime classical music fan.
Wonderful.
Many hundreds, thousands, really, of CDs and LPs, et cetera, and so forth. And I've completely given up purchasing hard copy media at all.
So no more CDs, no more even vinyl for you. It's all streaming. And where do you stream, John?
Streaming. I stream on Tidal. I stream on Beats, and I stream on Rhapsody. And if you put the three of them together, there's a lot of overlap, but you can get anything. I just went through a little marathon listening to Chopin's Preludes.
Yes.
And there were 27 different versions that I could get my hands on with no trouble whatsoever, and I could bounce back and forth between Rudolf Serkin and Murray Pariah with no trouble comparing how they handled the fourth prelude, the E minor, etc. I did the same thing with Beethoven's fourth over 17 different recordings.
It's kind of unbelievable, isn't it, John? I mean, it's a music lover's dream after years of hardware, as you put it, hard copies.
Oh, and you know, if I spend $35 for those three services a month, that is a fraction of what I used to spend on CDs, so big bonus for my pocketbook.
You sound like an aficionado. If Jay-Z says he'll give you a little bit better sonic quality, will that bring you to Tidal, John?
Oh, I'm on Tidal.
I mean, would it make it your home base? Or are you tuned? Is anybody tuned in anymore? There was a time when every little difference in sound quality was debated and discussed endlessly. And these days, people don't seem to care so much.
Well, as far as I go, I'll go to Tidal first. The sound quality is slightly better. Beats is real close. Rhapsody is down there, but Rhapsody has bigger coverage. So between the three of them, and just in terms of classical and jazz, like I say, I've got my priority list, but if Tidal doesn't have it, Beats or Rhapsody will definitely have it. So.
John, happy listening. All those different versions, different performances, back-to-back between, what in your case, Rhapsody and Beats and Tidal. It's fascinating how people are using this. Our listeners, maybe not so crazy about the new Tidal here, some of them, writing online, Cindy says, free version of Pandora works for me. Ben says, I don't know, seeing a bunch of a round table of millionaires and billionaires talking about revolutionizing music has not inspired me to spend twice as much. Gordon says, how about I spend $20 a month buying CDs, the original on-demand, high-quality audio. I want to ask you all also about those who have just pulled out here. I mean, big artists can swing a lot of what listening and more with their own decisions. Taylor Swift, here's a blank space. This is 2014. Her album, 1989. Last year, Swift pulled all of her music off of Spotify because she said she didn't think the streaming service fully valued her art. All her albums, other than 1989, are on Jay-Z's new service, Tidal. So it's gonna be forever, or it's gonna go down in flames. You can tell me when it's over, if the high was worth the pain. Got a long list of ex-lovers, they'll tell you I'm insane. Cause you know I love the players, and you love the game. Kelsey, now I'm not sure why you would pay any streaming service for that. It seems to play every, you know, 2.5 minutes on pop music radio. But why would Taylor Swift bail out on Spotify with all of those listeners that they bring to the table?
Yeah, so Taylor Swift's critique of Spotify is really one that only a huge star can make, someone in the top 1% of music. Mm-hmm. Because what she's saying is, I'm a massive star. And when I value my music, it's at a certain price point, and I expect people to pay for it.
Okay, okay.
For Taylor Swift, that's iTunes, right? She wants you to download her LP for $10.99 mm-hmm. and have the whole thing in hard copy. But not every artist can afford that. Does Taylor Swift have a point? Absolutely. Artists make a lot less on Spotify than they make if you buy their physical hard copies. The percentage of sales that they get is lower and lower because it has to go through like several different middlemen who are paying to get their music onto these services. But it's not a luxury that every single artist has, and it's certainly not a luxury that the majority of artists have. So when you hear Taylor Swift saying, like, I'm going to pull out of Spotify, what she's not saying, I don't think streaming is a good platform for my art. She's saying, I think my art is worth more money, which is why you see her art on Tidal, because they were willing to make a deal with her for her first few albums and give her a little more money. But not every artist can do that.
But that will only work over time if people are willing to come in, spend $20 a month instead of $10 to keep it all going. Atlanta, Georgia. Frank, you're on the air. What do you think, Frank?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. First, I just wanted to make a comment. It's interesting the panelists just mentioned a hard copy, getting a hard copy from iTunes. When the 1989 album came out, I actually purchased the physical disc for my daughters. So I'm a bit of an anomaly. I do buy CDs. I do use streaming services. But I do believe that a situation like Tidal, where you have a conglomerate of essentially top 40 artists, there's probably two or three top 40 stations in Atlanta. I don't listen to any of them because I'm generally like an indie rock kind of guy.
Okay.
I could tune in to any of those three stations at any given time and hear songs from these artists. Why will I pay $20 a month for Tidal on top of, you know, I'm already paying for SiriusXM, I use iTunes Radio, I buy CDs. Why am I going to pay $20 a month now for something I could listen to any of three different radio stations and get, you know?
That's a pretty straightforward question. Spencer, is Jay-Z got his finger on a viable model, business model here, or is Frank got it from Atlanta? No thanks.
I think he probably is not going to get everyone. He's not going to get a lot of people. He's talked about wanting Tidal to be kind of this Shake Shack to other services, McDonald's, or he's compared it to a $6 bottle of water, and that's like not as an insult, but he wants to be that $6 bottle of water, where almost what you're paying for is a like symbolic vote of confidence in these artists and in supposedly the future of music. It really is a pitch that relies a lot on these 16 musicians' credibility and fan bases. I don't see it appealing to anyone who isn't a diehard fan of them, because if you do want streaming, you can go to any other service. If you want the high fidelity, yeah, the title's for you. But other than that, it doesn't really offer very much other than that Spotify or theoretically Beats will provide.
Shake Shack, not Burger King. And then there's there's Beats, and they're promising some new kind of rollouts there. It's been all about customization. You log in. This is Apple's product they bought last year. Asks you what genres of music you listen to, which artists you like. They recommend what's best for you. They also promote new, interesting music like Sufjan Stevens' new album, Carrie and Lowell. Here's a track, Should Have Known Better. There from Beats, Sufjan Stevens, Kelsey McKinney, what's your sense of where Apple and Beats are headed to try and distinguish their offering?
Yeah, I think one problem that Apple and Beats are going to have in general is that they're trying to pull kind of the same move the Tidal is pulling right now, which is you pay us for your entry point, and we'll give you something that's a little more curated, something a little more for you, something a little more special. And what they're kind of saying there is we're not going to give you free entry, which is something that Spotify does, right? It's called the freemium model of like you come in, you can have all of our access to this, and then hopefully you'll upgrade. Mm-hmm. What Beats and Tidal are both doing right now is saying we're not giving you that option, but you get a higher quality product out of it. At this point, I'm not really sure what Beats' game plan is. They've been kind of off the map for a couple of months now with no real big news. They haven't launched a new platform. The one that they have is kind of, it lags a little and it's not perfect. And I think they're going to have a really hard time winning consumers when they don't have kind of the star power anymore that they had before Tidal was launched. I mean, Dr. Dre is a huge name. Is it as big as Jay-Z? No.
And Dr. Dre, of course, came with Beats. It was his. Here's a question, a comment from Christopher on Facebook. I mean, this gets down to just the technology side. He doesn't want to hear all this. He says, I don't need high quality. What I need is a stream that doesn't choke and buffer. So until they increase the throughput on cell phone towers and stop throttling my cell phone data streaming, what I really need is, say, a 32K, you know, stream in mono, not stereo, that sounds good on my cell phone headset, but doesn't choke and buffer. The choke and buffer lament out there, Spencer.
Yeah, I mean, that is one problem with this age of music listening is that you can't, it's not quite as reliable. You know, you used to be able to buy an album and have it in your car or wherever, in your Discman, or have it on your iPod, and it was yours, you had it. Now, you go in the subway and you might lose service and not be able to get it, listen to what you were listening to, or it's possible that your favorite artist, Taylor Swift, just deleted all her albums from Spotify and now you can't listen to them. So there's a lot more uncertainty for consumers now, and that is probably only going to grow. There is an option on these services, both on Tidal and Spotify, to download the tracks and listen to them offline, but that requires you to think ahead of time, okay, I'm going to want to listen to this before I go underground or when I'm somewhere with no service. So yeah, I think we may look back on the previous eras with some fondness for just the certainty that you had about the music you have. But we're also probably going to look back on this past couple of years where Spotify was dominant as a golden age of sorts for streaming because the marketplace is about to get a lot more crowded. There's going to be more competition. And competition is theoretically good, but it's going to cause these services to try to one-up each other, to deny things from each other, and that's going to make things a little bit more confusing for consumers.
So maybe the range gets fenced a little bit again as people try and get exclusive deals and advantage in this rapidly developing and huge now world. I mean, small compared to some things, but huge in its own terms of music streaming. Spencer Kornhaber with The Atlantic, wonderful to have you with us today for a look at this. Thanks a lot for joining us, Spencer.
Thanks.
And Kelsey McKinney, entertainment and culture reporter for Vox. You're terrific, Kelsey. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with a little Ghost Town, Madonna's 2015 song off her new album, Rebel Heart. Madonna, of course, also one of Tidal's 16 celebrity stakeholders. After the break, Alison Bechdel on her graphic memoir, Fun Home, going to Broadway. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Cartoonist Alison Bechdel is best known for her moving memoirs, Fun Home, a family tragicomic, and Are You My Mother, a comic drama about growing up in her troubled family. Fun Home became a hit musical off-Broadway in New York. Here's a bit from it. Alison's father, a closeted gay man, tries to get Alison to look less boyish. He's played by Michael Cerveris.
Where is your barrette? Put it back in. Keeps the hair out of your eyes.
So would a crew cut.
If I see you without it again, I'll whale you.
The show is now headed to Broadway and will be the first Broadway show with a lesbian lead character. Alison Bechdel is with us. You can join us, too. Are you a fan? What does her work mean to you? Alison Bechdel joins me now from Bolton, Vermont. Her graphic memoir, Fun Home, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's also author of the graphic memoir Are You My Mother and the long-running comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For. She was the 2014 recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. Fun Home opens on Broadway April 19th. Alison Bechdel, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. I'm very glad to be here. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's kind of you to say so. What's it been like for you to see this in pop-up form, I guess, from graphic memoir to stage, Alison?
It's been very trippy and surreal. It's been happening over a long period of time. It takes a long time for a musical to get produced. So it's been years that I've seen it take various forms, you know, from a staged reading to a workshop to the off-Broadway and now to this Broadway production. And it just keeps getting more amazing.
I don't know how young you began cartooning, but could you have imagined in your early days that one day these things would rise off the page and be on Broadway?
No. No, it's very bizarre. I personally have never been that that much of a theater person, but both of my parents really were. So I feel like in this odd way, having the book turned into a play is a strange kind of tribute to them. My parents met in a play. My mother acted in summer stock all her life. So it's kind of cool to see my parents turned into characters in a play.
You have such legions of fans, and they will know your story, which is the story of the memoir Fun Home and more very, very well. But for those who don't, Alison, can you give us just a sense of the childhood tensions and drama that you're depicting in Fun Home that that will be on Broadway?
Well, my memoir is about... it's really about just a few confusing months of my life in college. When I came out, I realized I was a lesbian my junior year of college. I told my parents this big news, and I found out in doing so that my father also was gay or bisexual, or at least had had affairs with other men and some of his high school students. So it was this very bewildering, confusing time, and then my father died. He was hit by a truck just a few months after this big revelation. And my family pretty much understood that as a suicide, that he had jumped in front of the truck. So that just compounded it. You know, it was this crazy, traumatic time in my life, and the book was my effort to sort that all out and figure out who my father really was.
Growing up, your dad was kind of obsessed with the house and furnishings and ornamentation. Was that his outlet for suppressed homosexuality?
Well, yeah, he certainly put a lot of libidinal energy into our home. We had he bought this old rundown Victorian house and spent the next 20 years fixing it up really very beautifully. But It was like he cared more about the house than the people in it sometimes. That's what it felt like.
I was really moved by Fun Home. It gets across so much that any family would relate to, and the sort of complexity of family emotions and relationships. But then the sexuality piece comes into it. There's a point at which you've got, you're writing in here, there's a certain emotional expedience to claiming him, your father, as a tragic victim of homophobia. But that's a problematic line of thought. Things get really complicated. Share a little bit of that with us.
Yeah, I didn't want to just write a book about being gay or the tragedy of my father's closeted life, because it's all much more complicated than that. You know, I don't think my father identified as gay. I don't think he would have thought of himself that way. And I don't know why he killed himself. You know, he certainly didn't leave a note, but it felt like somehow his life had become impossible once I had come along and, you know, blithely reported the news that I was gay. I just feel somehow like that made his life impossible. He couldn't see going forward with that possibility for himself, you know.
You mean the possibility of you being lesbian and...
I guess I feel like the possibility for him actually coming out and having a life where he wasn't
hidden.
Lying.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a connection?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you see a connection, Allison, between your sexuality and how you ultimately discovered and defined it and your father's struggle?
Well, I guess I feel like my whole life has been kind of devoted to this living very openly as a lesbian. I've never really had a real job. I just kind of became a professional lesbian as a young person. Mm-hmm. I started drawing this comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For. That was my job for many, many years. And I think that was probably a reaction to the kind of secrecy that I grew up in. I just didn't want to have...
Put it out there. Make it open. Live it.
Exactly.
I guess that still brings... We're talking with Allison Bechtel. Her graphic memoir, Fun Home, is headed to Broadway. I guess it still leaves me with that question of whether... I mean, you speculate in Fun Home, you know, if your dad had come out in his youth, of course, there's that old question, you know, if my dad... For anyone, if my mother never met my father, I wouldn't exist. Or if he or she had married someone else, I wouldn't be me. There'd be, but as to your sexuality itself, do you think that there's a relationship here between your father's and yours, or are these entirely independent things?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess I've always sort of felt like maybe 50% I inherited it. I don't, you know, 50% genetic and 50% the weird psychosexual dynamics of my family.
Do you really mean genetic, or do you mean inherited by environmentally being raised by your dad?
No, I mean genetic.
Huh.
I mean 50%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I don't,
maybe.
You know, honestly, I don't understand the science of all this. I don't think homosexuality is purely genetic, but I think that it's certainly... part of it sometimes, not always.
Allison, we've got listeners for you, people really excited to know that you would be on the air. Allison Bechtel with her long-running comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For, with her graphic memoirs, Are You My Mother, and Fun Home. It is headed this month to Broadway. It's being talked about as the first Broadway show that will have a lesbian protagonist. I'm scratching my head trying to think if that's precisely true. Maybe listeners can tell us. Carrie in Brooklyn, New York. Carrie, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Allison Bechtel.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Allison. Allison, I am going to see the show on Sunday for a matinee in the last Sunday in May with my best friend, who's also my ex. And I've seen the show already with my sister at the Public. It's fabulous. I mean, my sister and I loved it, and I was so excited that it was moving to Broadway, and my best friend would come down from Northampton, Massachusetts to see it. I've been a really big fan of the books for years, and it's just exciting.
It's terribly exciting. I'm so glad you're going to see it again.
I'm totally thrilled.
Carrie, share with us, what is it about these graphic memoirs that you found so compelling?
One of my friends said, they are like your friends, the characters in the books. And that is exactly how I felt about them. They are so identifiable, and they feel like your friends.
That kind of intimacy, it's true. It comes across between the writing here and the images, it's just a tremendous venue for a sense of intimacy with Allison's story. Carrie, I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for calling. Another from New York, Scarsdale in New York. Grace, you're on the air with Allison Bechtel.
Hi, Allison. This is Grace.
Hey, Grace.
You may not remember me, but I used to spar with you at the Women's Center Karate Club many years ago.
All right.
How are you doing?
Great. I just wanted to tell you that I've followed your career ever since those karate days, and I'd like to congratulate you. I'm very proud of everything you've done and to have known you and sparred with you, and I can't wait to see the show. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It's very exciting.
How was Allison's punch or her kick, Grace? Did she have a good kick?
She was really good. She was a formidable sparring partner, but a very honorable one also.
Oh, I love it. Oh, that's terrific.
Thank you, Grace.
That's terrific. Bring it right back. Allison, you did the Dykes to Watch Out For comic strip from 83 to 2008. That's a long time. You've been working in this vineyard for a long time. How's the story changed that you find yourself focusing on? I mean, not that sexuality is everything that you write or draw, of course, but it's been at the heart of it. And how's the lesbian experience? How do you find the story shifting or evolving over all those years?
Well, when I started drawing the comic strip in the early 80s, it was pretty much because I wanted that comic strip myself. I didn't really care if anyone else was reading it. I somehow needed to see a reflection of the life I was leading, and I drew funny pictures, so that seemed like a natural outlet. I just started drawing these cartoons about people like me and my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I mean, it was never ever about explaining or defending homosexuality. It was just a place where you took that for granted, and then people went on and had their normal lives. I really wanted to show lesbians just being real, regular people.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I guess, you know, the culture changed so much. In a way, the comic strip was one of the things I did in it, was to track these changes as gay and lesbian people became more and more assimilated into mainstream culture, what we were losing and what we were gaining in that kind of progress was something that really interested me.
At this point, how do you describe that gain and loss, major gains, major losses that have come with assimilation or more assimilation?
Well, when I was young, it never occurred to me, it was totally not on my radar, that gay people would ever get married to each other. It was just not something I thought about or that I think most of my friends thought about. And now, it's a reality. I find that really staggering. Like, it's a huge amount of progress in a very short period of time. And also, it's a little unmooring. So much of my identity as a gay person when I was younger was about being an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that has really been lost. Like, I, not completely by any stretch. There's still great struggles, as we can see going on in states like Indiana. Mm-hmm. Even today, there's plenty of homophobia to go around. But still, there's also way more acceptance to a degree that I could not have envisioned as a young person.
But does it make the lesbian life sort of bland as it becomes assimilated or more widely accepted? Is that part of what you're feeling?
Yeah, I guess
it's kind
of
weird, isn't it?
I know. I feel like, we've become sort of boring, but that's good. I wouldn't want to go back, but I do have a certain nostalgia for those sort of underground days. I mean, I wasn't even around when it was really underground, but
compared to now, maybe.
Yeah.
Tara in Spokane, Washington, you're on with Allison Bechtel. Tara.
Hi, Tom. Hi,
hi.
Allison.
Hi, Tara.
I was incredibly touched by Fun Home. I am a big fan of graphic novels. Fun Home is right up there with Blankets for me, and I'm particularly excited by graphic novels that are female-centric, because there are not as many of those as I would prefer, and very exciting to hear that it's going to be a show as well. I was wondering, what was next for you on the horizon writing-wise, and also if you had any recommendations of other graphic novels that are just a must-read in that vein of kind of the personal narrative.
Great. Thank you, Tara. Allison?
One cartoonist who springs to mind immediately is Gabrielle Bell. She does diary comics that are really wonderful called Lucky. I think she does them online. You can find her easily online. And as for what I'm working on next, I'm trying to find time. It's very hard with all this Broadway hubbub going on. But I'm trying to write another memoir, but not a family memoir. I'm giving my poor family a break. And I'm writing a book about exercise and physical fitness, which will touch on my brief karate career that we mentioned earlier.
Exercise and physical fitness. You've got a surprise every time we come to it. That's terrific. Allison, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today. It's really a pleasure. Gave me a good reason to read Fun Home and enjoyed it a lot. I wish success to the show on Broadway, and congratulations to you.
Thanks, Tom. It was fun talking with you.
Allison Bechtel, her memoir, Fun Home, a family tragicomic, going to Broadway this month. The original cast recording off Broadway behind us right here, Flying Away, this track. What a pleasure. What a privilege. Allison Bechtel, thank you for joining us. Listeners, thank you as well for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.